Laravel IO podcast. My name is Sean McCool, and I'm here with Jeffrey Way, Chris Vidal, and standing in for Taylor Otwell is Matt Machuga. Thanks, everybody, for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey.
Oh, so we have 1 week until Laracon in New York.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Crazy.
Matt, you haven't been on the show for a while, but, you know, you're pretty kind of thick into the community. Are you talking at Laracon, or?
No, I'm just going to hang out and pretty much do whatever.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. You show up at a lot of those events on the speaker list, so.
Yeah, I mean, it just didn't go, because I was going to give a JavaScript talk, and we had John Rezeg and everybody coming in, so I really can't compete against that.
Yeah, it's some stiff competition.
Yeah, I can't believe John's going to be there. That was crazy when Taylor told me that. I mean, that's a big deal. I'm curious how it's going to go over, because he doesn't really have any involvement in the PHP community. So I think he's talking about Khan Academy, which he works at. So I'm curious how that's going to tie in, if at all.
Oh, well, I love Khan Academy, and I hope he never goes into my account and looks at the things I've been working on. So that'd be really embarrassing for me.
Like basic algebra.
It's like real low-level stuff.
I'm excited to see how many people are going to be there. Like, because at the last one in Washington, that was, you know, a little over a year ago, I think we had maybe 100 people at most. Yeah. So, like, back then, it was pretty small. You know, it's kind of cool that, Matt, you were there, right?
No, that was right when my daughter was born. Like, I think I was in the hospital that week. She was born the week after, but I had to miss that one.
Okay, I guess it was just Sean. But anyways, it's kind of fun that we were there at the very first one, because I don't think it'll ever be like that again.
It was actually like artificially low attendance too, because they kind of decided, oh, 100 people, you know, we better get a real small venue just in case. But then a lot of people were on the waiting list and couldn't get in because, and that's the same as true this year. They went with like, I think like 200-ish people, maybe. I don't know. I don't know the exact number, but.
I think it's like 275.
Are you joking?
No, it should be about that much.
That's amazing. And still, there were a ton of people on the waiting list.
Yeah. And that was funny about ticket sales, too, because they were slow at one point. So every day Taylor is like, I don't know if we'll sell out. I don't know if we'll sell out. And of course they do. And then, of course, immediately once we announce it's sold out, like 80 people just sign up that day for the waiting list, you know?
Well, it's pretty much like sniping on eBay.
Yeah.
I'm going to take credit because like 8 episodes or 8 podcasts ago, I said that we were not going to have enough room. And Taylor was like, oh, I don't know. I just felt it. It was going to be way bigger than we had room for. So I'm taking credit for that.
Nice. He's not here to defend himself, so that's legit.
Exactly.
It's going to be.
Do we know what the after event parties are?
I don't know what anything is going on. I'm excited. I'm excited just to be there. Actually, we're going to be there from the 13th to the 19th, Mitchell and I. And I think that right after the conference ends, we're going to, like, just straight hackathon on the Laravel IO site. So if anybody wants to participate and you're going to be there, you know, a couple days after the conference, then let us know.
Nice.
Which, and it happens to be the topic of my talk, is that code base and the architecture of it, so that the way it's built. So that might be a good lead-in for people to come and, you know, kind of know what they're walking into, have an idea of, you know, how to contribute.
Yeah.
So will you be touching on CQRS and things like that?
Oh, nothing like that. I'm really focusing on an architecture that is based on use case kind of as a first class citizen, if that makes sense. And it uses like the command pattern from in a rich service layer to interact with the domain. So I'm going over the command pattern used in that way and then domain events. And that's pretty much all I'm going to have time for.
That's great. That's going to dovetail into what I'm talking about really great, really well, because I hit in those same points. I don't get into really how they work, but I use that as part of the broader scale of, like, this is an architecture you might want to look at.
Actually, like, a week and a half ago, just, like, trashed all my slides and started over. But I'm definitely liking kind of how it is now. It's a little bit simpler. I originally had, like, the story to go with everything, but now I just cut it out and just talking directly to devs. It's like, hey, devs, you guys know what, you know, controllers are and how things happen in the real world. So let's just, you know, talk about that stuff. And So when I did that, everything got way clearer, and I'm pretty happy with it. And plus, I'm like incredibly passionate about these techniques right now because just they're changing the way that I'm doing everything. Like I just recently started a few greenfield projects. I'm only, you know, doing this stuff all from the get-go, and things are just coming together in a really strange way, and I'm loving it.
Are you covering any of the philosophies behind Laravel IO itself, like kind of the discoverability stuff and kind of how we're trying to make a community center, which is kind of different from like a lot of the other dev communities do, where it's kind of scatterblasted?
Yeah, it's really like a half of a half type thing, like where I talk about what Laravel IO is, where it comes from, and also what we want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of talk about, you know, if you want to dig in the code base and help, because kind of the point of the whole app, right, is it's a free large app. It's like it's an MIT licensed large application. And you don't, you know, come across those every day. And, you know, we've had people message us saying we'd like to use this code base to run our own community. And so we're like, this is very cool. We want to do this. Just maybe allow us to come out with the next version if you want a better written one.
Right. Well, it's great when people come into the room. They're like, do you have an example of a Laravel app? And just, yep. Link them to the Laravel IO repo and just send them on their way.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you guys. And this is a little bit of a selfish question because it's going to possibly help me word some stuff in my talk. But I was wondering what you guys think about why architecture is worth talking about, is worth like caring about. Like, what is the goal of good architecture in your point of view?
Making our jobs better, like not miserable all the time. I guess even from the basics, I would say, like, if you come from, well, since you're doing a lot with bash files and things lately, let's look at it like that, like one giant bash file is just full of procedural mess and nothing makes sense, or a nicely structured application where you can clearly find what you're looking for. So that's like the ground level, and then you can get into object-oriented or different like functional paradigms, or even a well-structured procedural. It makes your life better. You don't struggle. Your IDE can figure out what you're doing. Yeah, that's just my take on it.
Yeah, for me, it comes down to just handling stress. You know, like when, like Matt was talking about with that procedural code, you can fall into these situations where you don't even want to open up a class, you know, because it's just gross and you're terrified to make any changes, maybe because there aren't any tests behind it. And so it's kind of that forbidden zone where you just kind of keep those sets of classes out of the way. And that's really bad. You know, you can't clean up your app. What's the best way to phrase this?
Like refactoring or just in general?
Yeah, like obviously it's never good when you're terrified to touch a class. And I think everyone knows that feeling, whether it's your code or some legacy app that you inherited. So for me, that's the primary reason why I would focus on many of these techniques, is just to make it so that never happens. And it doesn't get more complicated than that for me, at least.
I kind of think of architecture as like, just like a tool. So you have your IDE, and it has all these abilities and everything in it, but then you have your code, and your code is almost like a user interface in itself, right? So systems with different architecture have different ways that you interact with them in order to achieve different goals. In my mind, a really simple architecture for a really simple site is just perfect, but a really simple architecture for a really complicated site is impossible to do well. It's impossible to do right. It's just, it's going to fall apart. It's going to be difficult to manage. You have to increase the complexity in order to make something that's very complex more simple. It sounds contradictory, but it's just the way it is. Architecture to me is about designing things in a way that it'll grow and not become more complicated as a result.
Right. Yeah, that sounds great. Like what I'm hearing is that it's really about maintainability and kind of like almost a long-term concept. Because as your site grows, you're going to increase complexity, but you want to reduce technical debt also, right? So the architectural concerns that go into that might be really important to reduce the technical debt overall, or keep it as low as you can.
Yeah, so an example would be, for example, the open-close principle, which says that in order to add new functionality to a system, you would like to be able to do so by adding new code, not editing existing code. And so one way of doing this is to inject things into a specific class. So I have an HTML to Markdown converter that I've been working on. And basically, you can add new tags just by creating a new derivative class of like a tag superclass or a tag interface. I don't even remember. But you just inject these into the converter, and then it'll loop through them to figure out how to handle various DOM elements. And if it can't be handled, it just ignores it, right?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. The tough thing about the solid principles is, like, I think newcomers learn about this and think they are law. You have to follow them. So in the case of OpenClose, like, if you were to edit an existing class, then somehow you're breaking the law. And it's like, it's just not like that. These are, I think of them more as guidelines. Like, this is something you should strive for. But also, at the same time, if you adopt this methodology that you never edit a class once it's done, well, then you can very quickly end up with a bunch of code bloat because you're extending classes and all of that. So it's like, at least in my mind, it's a good idea. I don't know. You guys know what I'm talking about at all? Like, it's something you should strive for, but it's not law.
To me, each of the principles are pretty different. Like, OpenClose is describing a workflow, how you would work with the code base. So you aim to put things together in a way that allows you to, over time, do this. So OpenClose requires you to kind of decide what is going to change in the future so that you can set up your system so that that specific kind of change is easy. So if you know, okay, I'm going to be continuing to add new types of tags, then you make it so that you can just inject tags and it works in a way that it loops through the tags and does what it needs to do. That's because you're predicting that there will be more tags in the future. Sometimes
that's
you
a
can
good
do
scenario,
that.
But sometimes many times, you can't. Yeah, many times you just have no idea what you're going to need to do. So I guess that's what I was trying to say. Like, it's something you push for, and in your case, that's a perfect example of it, where you can kind of predict what you're going to need to do so you can structure your app in that way. But then in other cases, you just can't predict as well as you would want to.
Yeah, but like in Liskov's substitution principle, I mean, if you think about that, you would just never want to violate that. I mean, what possible reason could you have to allow, you know, a refused bequest? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to play devil's advocate a little bit and ask you guys, at what point do you start optimizing your object graphs a little bit? Like, in my JavaScript projects, it's become kind of a thing where I have to start trimming down because things are moving too slow, and I have the 60 frame per second limit I have to hit. And in Rails, in ActiveRecord, a lot of objects are spawned off to do simple things like find a record. So Aaron Patterson has been working on something he calls Adequate Record, where it trims down all the extra cruft to see what he can get it down to and still keep the system organized. Have you guys run into anything where you have to optimize yet, or is everything still, for the most part, running fast?
Really, everything's been running fast for systems I've worked on. Granted, the majority of my days right now are working on an older app that's kind of getting modernized slowly. But even then, nothing really gets too slow.
In my experience, people do the opposite. They try to optimize way too early when they have no need to whatsoever.
Yeah, right. Oh, and that really gets into this concept of, man hours being more expensive than computation, right? So buying servers is cheaper than the man hours you would put into trying to make it faster.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things I see with especially students coming out of computer science degrees, they're all like super focused on speed. Like everything has to be fast. And then we spend a couple years kind of getting them to think, no, a better structured architecture works for you. And then at some point they run into it. Okay, we got to make it fast again. It seems like that transition is kind of hard for people to get back into. So I'm just always curious to hear how other people have to optimize when they're kind of pressed up against the wall.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty normal for people who are new or whatever to focus on performance, because so much of your life is battling against the computers, battling against the sluggishness. Your computer's not fast enough to run a game. The internet's too slow. So I think it makes sense to think about it from that perspective, but only when you really know, okay, where are the slowdowns actually coming from? Do you realize kind of where you have to put your efforts?
And I think better tooling like HHVM kind of enables us to think more in the object-oriented way, or in just I can expend effort to, you know, like I can expend the cycles on the CPU to make my code cleaner and then let the compiler do what it's supposed to do and optimize for me.
Yeah, having a compiler is a great help in that. But also, like when you're talking about Rails and Active Record, I can't help but to think that are there more bloated things in modern web development than Rails Active Record?
Not much.
So, like, to me, I'm kind of at this point where like, I'm pretty disillusioned with Active Record as a pattern. I think it's not as good a fit all the time as... I mean, we just use it for everything. I mean, do you guys use anything besides Active Record, like, all the time? I mean, yeah, you know, you probably use Doctrine at some point in time or whatever, but I just think that it's pretty clear that I have been using Active Record in situations where it probably wasn't a good fit. And maybe if we're using a different kind of mapping system, we don't run into so many performance problems, and we can focus on that object-oriented design. I keep coming back to the feeling that over and over again, from like the CodeNighter days on, slowly, bit by bit, the tools have changed and our knowledge has changed to the point where we're able to get closer and closer to that object-oriented design. But it's always felt wrong in one way or another. It's felt wrong for the fact that there are global super objects in like CI, or you're not actually really working in the object oriented way. And then using Active Record where we shouldn't, it has always kind of backed us into a corner to the point where we're not doing that object-oriented design that we think of when you're learning object-oriented design, like what's a shape? You know, a circle inherits from shape or whatever, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think the Active Record pattern has like sent everyone down a path where they think too much about persistence right off the bat. And... like, I know it screwed me up for a couple years, and honestly, like, it's great when you're getting started, and it's awesome when, like, you just want to pound something out real quick, but as soon as you get into those, like, large app situations, it gets kind of frustrating, because you just want, like, a really small object that's not carrying a lot of weight, not carrying a lot of methods, and you just want to do, like, real simple things with it, but you have to bring the entire database with you, or it has to map exactly to a database table or row. Yeah, mm-hmm. It just gets frustrating for me after a while. I'm pretty over it for most applications.
In fact, everything I've ever read, like the more you get into this higher level of architecture and call it quote unquote higher level, but the more you read about it, and all these books we read are from people in, you know, doing Java and Smalltalk and stuff like that. But the more you read, the more you realize how much you butt against Active Record in almost every instance. Especially when dealing with things like a repository pattern, especially when you start reading about domain-driven design, where you want this like rich domain layer. But right off the bat, we're tying a database to it. So you're doing multiple things in this class that should really, you know, ideally, when the situation merits it, it should just be this entity that has some business logic that defines some constraints and behavior. But now we're also doing persistence with it.
Yeah, for... it seems like our domains should be for high-level policy, and we're mixing too much direct implementation in there, and it's making things more difficult to work with. So our domains end up being this strange mix of service layer and domain combined.
Oh, for sure. And like it can get really frustrating after a while because you have to carry the weight, and like things that you want to optimize, you can't do it. It's not possible. And like, you know, you can create value objects to kind of work that direction, but they're still sitting on an Active Record based object.
Right. For me, it always seems like this constant struggle between convenience and maybe like, well, I don't know what you'd call it, architectural purity or whatever. But it's always like, okay, well, maybe, especially with Laravel, like if you want to not use Eloquent and Laravel, you can do it, but it seems like in the process you make all of these sacrifices. And so many times I come back to this thinking like, is it worth it? Is it worth all of this added complexity just to get some of these benefits? And I haven't made up my mind just yet. You know, you can use Doctrine with Laravel if you want, but like, I get mad at Doctrine because it's not... you know, it's not intuitive for people who don't use Doctrine. It seems like you either love Doctrine to death or you haven't even gotten past the introductory tutorial that's on their website. So that gets annoying for me. Like it sort of ties in a little bit with what DHH was talking about during his TDD keynote, where are we abandoning things like Active Record to make our applications far more complex? Is that something we're doing?
Just as a quick note, a developer I work with, Mitchell von Weingarde, he is working on this package called Laravel Doctrine, and I know there's already one out there, but it directly ties into all of the Laravel configurations, and the design is to have it melt into Laravel. So you're still doing your connection configurations and stuff all the same way. It's not like Doctrine just bootstrapped into Laravel. It's like more of a melting. So you might check that out on packages or GitHub or whatever. It's Laravel-Doctrine. It's in the Mitch namespace. He says it's going to be, ready for other people to check out when this hits, like, probably the podcast comes out probably like tomorrow.
Cool. I'll check it out.
I'd be interested to see if it like implements the interfaces needed for user management too, like the authentication library. Oh,
and I meant to say, he has traits. It comes with traits and stuff so that you can just do in your entities, use timestamps, and it'll have the same kind of functionality that Eloquent timestamps has, and use soft deletes, and it adds soft deletes all just by slapping in a trait.
Neat. I like traits.
Yeah, I used to be really against them, but the more I've kind of gone down this road, the less against them I get.
Yeah, tacking on a grouped up functionality is a really good use case for them. So it's definitely good to see.
So, testing. You want to talk about testing?
What did you guys think of DHH's keynote? Did anyone agree with him?
I did to an extent.
Yeah, agree with which points, because that's his nature of making the extremist notions, and it's really great to stir people up talking. So
yeah, he knows what he's talking about, so people are saying he's being inflammatory. Well, he's smart enough to know that if you just go right along the middle, then nobody's going to talk. So being a little inflammatory is what he's trying to do, you know? And so I don't think you should be knocked for that.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Well, it's annoying because like so many people, like I think he has earned the right to be respected, and what he says I think should be considered. And so many people just immediately took his talk without even really taking 5 minutes to think about it and disregarded it as him basically being an idiot and not knowing what he's doing and not knowing what TDD is. And for me, I feel like that's insulting. Just because he built Rails doesn't mean he's automatically right, but I think it does deserve a discussion and consideration without completely disregarding him as somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. That's right. Ridiculous, in my opinion.
Yeah, just because DHH built Rails doesn't mean he's an idiot.
Oh, God.
I liked his talk. I thought it was really good. It was really interesting. It had a lot of good points. I think there's a lot of philosophy in there that doesn't directly relate to just whether or not to do TDD. To me, it was more like, don't buy into a specific religion when it comes to these methodologies. You know, I think that was what the talk is about less about testing and test first and more about, come on, guys, let's not get into groups and start, attacking each other.
Mm-hmm. And he's really into pragmatism, so I mean he doesn't like the zealotry behind a lot of it, and I don't blame him. Is that even a word, zealotry? Anyway, so like a lot of that makes sense, and I don't know. A lot of people in response gave like a good kind of like back and forth on that. Like Gary Bernhardt's post, I thought was really well written, and it showed the pros behind it, but. You know, for a lot of the people using Rails, they probably don't need TDD, so it probably does make sense. It's just like when you get into that testing mindset, you're either for it or, I mean, we see a lot of people in Laravel and IRC where they test, but they don't test first. Doesn't mean anything's wrong with what they do at all.
How do you guys test? I'll preface that by saying I tend to spike and stabilize. I don't know if that's a term I think Ruby Programmer came up with.
In Java for a long time. Yeah, in all Java. Right.
I first heard about it from Grumpy Programmer, so I'll give him credit. But basically, like, I go in not really knowing what interface I want in my classes, right? Kind of like the public interface that other classes use. But I'll refine that when I test. So I'll make the code work and then start refining it. And that's when I add tests. And as I test, I fix bugs. And I've always found bugs when I've tested. And I refine the API at that point. I don't, like, go into it knowing what I want it to look like at the end. But I also have mentioned that, and some people have said, yeah, that's basically test-driven development. But I think the difference is, it's slightly different, right? Because I'm not writing a test first. I'm writing code first. So I don't know what you guys did.
What some people would say is it's fine if you just want to, you know, that's that stage where you need to write a test, but you just don't really know what you're doing yet. So some people would say, yeah, tinker around, play, do a little bit of prototyping. But when you're done and you have a better understanding of what you want to do, delete all of that and then begin again with TDD. And it'll turn out a little bit different than you did before. And I kind of like that methodology. I think that makes sense in my mind, if that's the way you want to go about it.
I guess in regards to new features, I tend to poke around, like, you know, I'll spike something out and then I'll go back and change it, make it the way I want and clean up the interfaces. Cause sometimes when I'm going through, I pick really horrible names for things. So I can kind of fix that up later. If I'm refactoring or if I need to fix a bug, I'm really big into, writing a failing spec for it first, like an integration spec or an end-to-end or however you want to call it, where I can see how it's actually failing, and then I can go in and repair that. And I guess it depends on the project whether I actually will do, like, the unit test first, but mostly I just want something to prove I've actually fixed it at the end of it. Other than that, I'm pretty liberal about it.
Yeah, I do test first on accident, so I'll figure out kind of how I want the code to run, and I'll test it, but when I get tired of going back and forth to, like, looking at the code and testing stuff and I need to add a new feature or something, then I might just start stubbing out the tests ahead of time. And I've done experiments with TDD over and over again with multiple partners. We sat down doing pair programming just to kind of build projects and explore. And honestly, I never really felt like I was just good enough for it, like I was skilled enough to do it. It's not for me, at least not right now, but I still think as a discipline, I have respect for it and I consider it something that's worth exploring. And I think that by pursuing TDD, you will become a better developer. You will become better at testing and writing code, even if you don't want to use TDD. I think it's just another one of those pursuits. I don't really believe that there are finite things that you should be doing specifically. I think that you just have to find a pursuit, have a good enough sense of taste to choose one that's going to give you value, and then at the end you have the value, and then you can just go on to the next thing, continue to drive value from whatever.
I feel like people who pursue the craft of coding, in other words, are always kind of looking to improve how they do it. I feel like test-driven development is getting up towards after a few years of that, right? So it's kind of like a natural progression where you just lay some code down and it works, like kind of like CodeIgniter style, I guess. But even that's without a framework, so you don't necessarily start there. But then you learn more and more. You might read about some of these architectural concerns, and then testing gets involved. And then test-driven development is kind of a natural evolution of your learning almost. So I don't even know, like, does it make sense for people to just jump into test-driven development for people who have never written tests before?
Oh, no. No, I mean, you can't. Like, you can't even do TDD if you don't have a decent object-oriented design. So you can try, and it's going to make you realize, holy crap, I need to improve my object-oriented programming. It's just impossible.
But that's sort of what DHH was talking about. Like, so many times when you, if you were to ask, or if somebody new to this stuff were to ask, well, why are you doing that? Why are you injecting this in there? And then our natural response is, oh, this makes it a lot more testable. And that's sort of what he's going after. It's like, okay, so you're making your code just incrementally less intuitive to make it more appealing to the tests. And is that a good thing? And I totally get what he's saying from that point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really valid concern in that situation. You should never, like, tear up a good code to make it testable if you don't have a reason to do it that way.
Right. Especially in the PHP world, like, we don't have some of the flexibility that the Ruby community does. So some of these things we have to do. You know, we can't just stub out existing classes. You know, we just can't do that on the fly. So I it does seem like it's this constant struggle of making your code testable versus sacrificing the readability in the process. And is that something we really want to be doing?
I loved all of DHH's examples about code that was hacked up just to make it testable, because that's how I do it. Like, all of his examples were how I do it. But it's just, it's like, it's that thing where you can get away with no complexity, and that's fine. But, you know, I have this, for example, the enterprise apps I work on are so big that it's just impossible to do it with directly accessing Active Record in the controller. And I'm sorry, I'm just not going to agree with directly accessing Active Record in the controller when it comes to, you know, building apps. I think that that's something that you can do, and that's fine, in a really, like, light case scenario. But when it comes to client work and building stuff for your clients, it's almost like, I don't know. I don't think it's great.
Right. And I want to save some of the stuff for your talk, but I think the use cases really get into that, like how you define ways your application can be accessed.
Yeah.
And when you write stuff directly in the controller, you get away from the ability to do that, because then you'll be repeating code in your REST API controllers versus your, you know, normal browser web request controllers.
But then at the same time, would you tell somebody who is new to Laravel that they should never use Eloquent within their controllers?
No.
Actually, I would inform them. Yeah, I would just inform them to go ahead and start this way, because to me, you have to start somewhere, and that's fine. You can change things later. Like, you can refactor an app, but it's just going to cost time. And sometimes that time is okay, like when you're getting started and you're learning or whatever. And sometimes that cost just costs your company tons of money.
Yeah, I really view it like kind of climbing up a ladder. And each rung, you're learning something, and you're deciding, is this right for me in this situation? And as you're learning, you don't know enough to make those decisions for the most part. So, I mean, it's pretty much like when all the folk were coming in saying, I want to make a repository for this, but they couldn't understand PHP syntax. It's like I really like that you're excited, but you should take a step back just to understand what's happening and what kind of benefit this repository is gaining for you.
Jeffrey, do you want to kind of tell us, or Chris, whoever feels better about this, you want to tell us a little bit about Grumpy's recent newsletter?
Okay, so basically, Grumpy Programmer sent out a newsletter. He does one like a month, every month. And I can't remember exactly what he said. Mostly, it was somewhat complimentary to Laravel, surprisingly, because he's hard to figure out. Sometimes he says he doesn't like Laravel. Sometimes he seems to be a little more friendly. I think he's just one of those anti-framework people, which is tough, and that's another discussion. But mostly, he was complimentary of it, but then it was always kind of shadowed by, oh, I would never use it. But it's not the worst thing in the world. It's sort of what I took from it. What did you guys take from it?
One of the points was about how the framework was partly successful for its good marketing, which I disagree with.
Disagree as well.
I think it's an easy one to disagree with, right? Because the framework has a lot of benefits, you know, all the things we've ever talked about, from, you know, the ease of use when you get started, and how it grows with you as you become a more knowledgeable developer.
I will say Taylor's marketing's kind of good, because he really likes the suspense, and he has a lot of fun, so I think it works.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Taylor knows what he's doing when it comes to marketing. And I would say he, especially in the PHP world, maybe does it better than anyone. Even like he, for example, at the upcoming Laracon, he's going to release something that I think is pretty big. And he keeps sending out little teasers. Like I think he was tweeting MD5'd versions of Little Clues. And I think that's like incredibly smart. And it's something that not many people do. So he understands that yes, Laravel is a very good framework. It's very well built, but it's also a product, and he handles it really well. So I do think that factors in. It's just not the only reason why Laravel is big, clearly.
Right, yeah.
I think there's like two things at play here. I think that from the very beginning, Laravel was very community-centric, and I think that that's one of the primary reasons that it grew in the way it did. And I also think that there was a very clear vision from the beginning, and the vision is simplicity and flexibility, and what all of this marketing is just a consequence of the vision, right? So it's just that, like, the communication of what this thing is and where it comes from. So, I mean, to me, Laravel's a success because what it is, the vision behind it, resonates to a lot of people. I think that's the major factor. And then the fact that we have this really compelling community that's there to help and support the product and that kind of thing. I think that that's a major factor as well.
Well, for a period there, the Laravel community was being branded as these, like, arrogant people who would jump on you if you said anything. And I have no idea where that came from. It would just be these random, like, These, like, Twitter conversations where somebody would say something. Somebody in the Laravel community would say, wait, can you elaborate on that? And then suddenly the Laravel community was pouncing on them. And it just, that wasn't the case. Well, you know, I think the Laravel community is incredibly friendly.
The Laravel community is incredibly friendly. However, like, I think that Taylor disallowing Robo from being on the Git issues and stuff is a little bit telling. I think that there were a few people who have, like, a really kind of trolly sense of humor that kind of gave a lot of people, like, for example, I talked to these people in this local user group, and they are of the opinion that Rob Clancy is the largest ass in the history of the internet. And to kind of know the guy, you know that he's different than that, but he sure as hell comes off that way. I mean, it's just, that's the way it is. But
that's 1%. 1% of all people are jerks.
I think that when it comes to the internet, the only thing that matters is what you see. And I think that if Rob or other people like that are on there kind of making jokes or being kind of mean or whatever, then that makes a huge impact. So I really think a lot of that comes from there. Plus, you know, during the whole everybody hate Laravel thing that lasted about 2 months, right? I think a lot of people got really defensive, and when they turn around and react like that, it gives maybe an inaccurate perception that this is just how they are. But in reality, you don't know that they're kind of a little bit annoyed and struggling themselves with certain aspects. So I don't know. I think it's easy to see how this kind of thing comes about. I just think that, you know, you can't really judge a book by its cover. And the fact that it all washed over. Yeah, it's true.
That's what they were doing. They've never used Laravel. So many of these people had these incredibly strong opinions about the framework, and they will freely admit, even Grumpy Programmer, going back to his newsletter, he will freely admit that he doesn't use the framework, yet he has these big opinions on it. And that's, like, something that only happens in our community, right? You've never used it, yet you have this strong opinion on whether it's a good thing or not. Where does that come from?
Well, yeah, we also had, like, a lot of the people who were acting defensively. I mean, that's a typical thing. If someone's attacking something you're attached to, you feel like you have to defend it. And, I mean, it's good to resist that urge, because a lot of times you don't need to defend something, like horrendously bad, because no one's attacking Taylor. No one's actually going after him with a knife or something. They're just saying, like, well, you should not call this a facade or something like that. And we had a lot of people coming out with, like, a lot of strong beliefs, like somebody was insulting them directly as people. And, like, that was something Jesse O'Brien and I have been joking about, where at Laravel or at LayerCon, we're going to start wearing shirts that said, like, Laravel sucks, just to see who actually came up and started trying to fight about it. We're like, no, we're good, man. Like, we're not trying to aggravate anybody. It's just, like, you gotta accept that some people have different opinions about tools.
No, we're just trolls, and we're making you better.
Also, have you ever discussed the fact that Rubbo changed his GitHub icon to be a troll?
To make it more obvious.
Doll. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I know he gets bad on there, but that was one of the funniest things I've seen, just because I caught it kind of, like, out of the side of my eye. I was like, what is that? Oh, my goodness. If nothing else, he's funny. Like, I get why people get rubbed the wrong way, because we have, like, what, a year or two exposure to him, so we're kind of used to it, and we know he's just goofing off or drunk. But, yeah, I can definitely see why people get rubbed the wrong way.
But he's one person. That's not, like, even remotely reflective of the community. Like, if you want to look at the Laravel community, look at all of the books and the sites, all of these dedicated sites, Laravel.io, Laracast, Laravel Tricks. There's just nonstop stuff dedicated to the framework because people love it so much. Like, when I wrote about this in my book, where when I first kind of got friendly with the community a couple years ago, Dale immediately said, "Welcome to the family." And I love that because that's kind of how it feels, like a big little family. And plenty of people like Phil Sturgeon would say, you know, don't create silos, but, you know, these things are good. We are nice people, excluding just a handful of trolls who know exactly what they're doing. They're entertaining themselves. So I don't know Rob specifically, but I would imagine he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's just entertaining himself.
Yeah, and it's nice to have our little niches where – no, you're pretty much right. It's nice to have our niches where we can go and communicate and actually feel like a family. And I think Dale's been great at doing that overall. Like, we have warm, fuzzy red panda as pretty much the Laravel mascot, and that's pretty representative. Like, in IRC, we're all buddy-buddy. Like, we all know each other. We all talk. And, you know, every couple months there's kind of a change of the guard of who comes in. The newbies become – you know, more or less experts, and they're helping people. I've seen somebody get help the day before, and now they're helping people understand what they did. So, you know, it works up the chain, and people really do give back once they are taught something by another community member. And, like, that's the kind of stuff that I really like to see.
Yeah, so people, anybody listening should feel free to drop by the Laravel IRC channel on irc.freenode.net. The Laravel.io website actually has an embedded chat client, so if you don't want to go through the trouble of getting a client, whatever, drop by, ask questions, hang out, read what other people are asking and talking about, you know, help somebody, pay it forward.
Actually, Jeffrey, from you saying I'm always in IRC a couple episodes ago, somebody came in yesterday and checked. Is it like Machuga? I'm like, yes. He's like, oh, you are always here.
I mean, he's like a robot, like, is Matt in IRC.com?
Well, I think people who don't use IRC think that you're just there all the time. And it's like, no, it may be open, but you're working, you know? And you'll get a notification if somebody messages you. But.
Plus, he uses a bouncer.
Yeah. Yeah, so I literally look like I'm there all day. But, nice. You know, like from 8 to 5, some Eastern time, normally people can get a hold of me if they ping me. I mean, it's not like I'm always sitting there like, oh, please, somebody talk to me. I'm normally like pairing with somebody at work or just working away and something on my own, then I reply when I get a chance. But I mean, that's how IRC works. So if you like that extra asynchronous communication where, you know, you can respond if you want, just go sit in the room, like hang out. If you have a question, you just tab over to it, ask, and go back to what you're doing until somebody replies, or you could meet new friends like we did.
I have a side topic question that I just thought of as you were speaking. For those of you who have done pair programming, how does that work for you guys? Or, like, how do you accomplish it?
Jeffrey, do you want to start?
I haven't done it that much, honestly. I don't know how much I like the idea. I don't know. I think people feel pressured into doing it, and maybe it's a great thing for you, or maybe you just don't have the personality type that's good for it. But personally, it's not something I do very much.
I can tell you from my experiences that when I'm sitting down with like Mitchell and we're working through a problem together, whether it's on the whiteboard or in code, I mean, that's when we do our best work, because I'll start down a path and Mitchell will be like, hold on, you know, what about this or something like that? And then we'll be forced to stop and deal with that idea. And then we think that idea through, and then we have a new path and we just keep going like that. So, I mean, that to me is some of the most rewarding time development I ever have.
Absolutely. And like Jeffrey's reservations on it are what you'll normally find out in the wild. People get worried that they won't be able to think, or they don't really want to talk to people while they're working. And it's completely understandable. Like sometimes even us at work, we get tired and we just need to sit by ourselves for a little bit because we've had too much interaction, or we need to like start reading through things and take a while to think. But like when we sit down together, kind of, well, remotely, I have to connect to people through Screen Hero. But when we sit down and work on something, it's like you have somebody to verify what you're doing is sane and it's not leading you into a trap, or like your names are actually clear. You pretty much also have a human compiler right there, since we're in PHP. They can kind of, well, mine's JavaScript, but like you can catch what you're doing as you're going through it. Or like if you're tracking kind of an event system, it makes it really easy to trap yourself into a corner and somebody can say, hey, this is going in a circular dependency now. You just did this in the other file. And, you know, it saves you 20 minutes of debugging. Or just the ideas that you can come up with together are, there's a fair chance it's going to be better than something you come up with on your own because you have them to verify it and you can kind of use the rubber duck technique and just talk it out.
I wouldn't doubt that. Some people take it really far where it's like, okay, this person is in charge of writing a test and then this person's in charge of making the test pass. Do you follow that kind of methodology at all? Or is it more just working together?
It's mostly working together. Cause like, I mean, ping ponging is kind of fun where, well, like you can alternate who does the test, who does the whatever. But usually if we're pairing, we're trying to work something out. Like something isn't going right or we're trying to fix some bug that came in. So like the number of tests we usually have to write are fairly low. So it's just kind of, we'll write the integration spec at the beginning, make sure it's failing, and then just kind of start diving in from there.
Mm. Yeah. Like Mitchell and I don't work together on the same computer just because we want to, like we are working on our own separately, but when we have a problem that we need to fix, like an architectural problem, and we're thinking, okay, well, where does this need to be? Let's think it all through. And that's when we do a lot of the whiteboard stuff. And then that's when we sit down on the computer and start banging stuff out. It's working on the whiteboard with a group of people and sitting down on the computer programming with a group of people is like the same thing to me. You don't do it all the time. You just do it when you need to overcome a problem. And other people may have their own experiences with this. I have no clue. All I know is, you know, what we do, and we only get together long enough to kind of create an understanding. And once we have that understanding, and once we have all that worked out, we can split up and I work on my part and he works on his part because we're of the same mind at that point. And also, I mean, I just want to throw this in there that I feel like I have grown so much as a developer from being able to pair with Mitchell that I have just very positive feelings about sitting down and working on code with another person now.
That's awesome. I've always wondered about how you avoid kind of running into each other, like editing the same file or, you know, just other stuff where you kind of get in each other's way.
Yeah, that's the beauty. When you're working with other people, you both know what the goals are and you just split up the tasks.
Yeah, it's a pretty great experience when it actually, like when you start gelling with the other person, if you're kind of conflicting personalities or conflicting thought patterns, sometimes it works to your benefit, but other times it just gets really frustrating and you should probably rotate out with someone else. But it's also a really great way to pick up like kind of tips and tricks in your environment. So like we have a bunch of Vim users at work and, you know, like today I asked my coworker to hit control caret, which is control six, and that'll just pop you back to the last buffer you were on. And he didn't know about that. And, you know, from him, I learned about unite.vim and that got me some cool stuff. And then I've been pairing with some Emacs guys lately and I've kind of been switching over to Emacs just under the radar a little bit. And I'm still using Vim inside of Emacs in a weird way I'm not going to go into, but, I've learned a lot through him. So like that's been beneficial to me outside of the programming itself, but to help me integrate my environment without taking up a lot of time trying to have somebody introduce it to me after hours. So there's some added benefits. It's kind of nice. Plus I get to socialize instead of sitting in my office alone all day.
Nice. Do we all work remotely in this podcast right now?
I do.
Oh, wow. I think we do. Well, Sean, you got your office, but you're technically remote from all your clients, right?
Yeah. Nick, Mitchell, and I, we got an office together, but we're all independently self-employed, and we all have our own clients, even though we work on stuff together as well.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's just kind of neat.
Remote teams.
Yeah. Of course, I guess that explains how we're at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time doing a podcast.
Yeah, yes, pretty much.
It's 9 p.m. for me.
Would not be possible.
Right.
Can I change the subject a little bit? I'd love to talk about sequential tasks. This is something I think is really, like, if you come across some kind of GitHub application, I feel like if you look at the person's controller, that gives you a really good idea of what kind of developer they are. It just shows you, like, how they go about things. Are they the types that use application services? Are they the types that put everything in the controller? Do they use something like CQRS? You know, you can learn a lot about a person by, or a team, by what their controller looks like. So What do you guys personally do in those situations where the example I always use is, say, a user signs up for your application, all right? And if you read the general tutorials we do, usually it's very simple. You just create the user and redirect. But we know that in real life that doesn't happen, right? You have to do all of these things, like you need to sign them up for a newsletter. You need to send them a welcome email. Maybe you want to schedule some kind of follow-up email 3 weeks later. You know, there's all of these various things that you need to do when this action happens. So I'm curious, how do you guys handle that? Do you fire events? Like, do you just put it all in your controller? Do you create an application service and then just do it sequentially in there? How do you guys tackle this stuff?
So I like to use events. And my thinking there is that anything that's not primary to that action, so for instance, creating a new user, could be, I'll call it a secondary action, but I'm just making up that term off the top of my head. And that will be driven by, right, that will be driven by events. So I create a user, and that event itself will trigger other events, sending an email, getting this person in a drip marketing campaign, sending them for a newsletter or whatever, which gives you a few things. Like, one, you're not kind of muddling up this use case, this code of creating a new user with other concerns. And then at the same time, you're also giving yourself an avenue to asynchronously do the other tasks. So the events could fire to a queue job, and that could get run in the background somewhere. Or maybe sometimes your events actually have to do something complicated, and that will go back into your application and do like this whole other thing that could be, you know, almost the result of another web request. You know, it's something complicated enough where it's like another use case of your application that just happens to have to follow this one other use case. Cause your events are almost like a controller, right? They can potentially do all these things to your application. So it's kind of like, use an event to offload other concerns from that one initial action that fires off that event.
Now, do you have like a single event handler class where you handle everything related to that? Or do you use other classes to handle these events? For example, you could have some kind of user event handler or user signs up handler class or something. And then within there, once again, if you wanted to, you could just kind of do it procedurally. You inject everything you want, your mailer, your newsletter sign up, whatever. And then once again, you could just do it procedurally in there. But then at that point, are you saving too much effort? Or yeah. Do you handle these in other classes? So yes. You have one event handler that listens for when a user signs up, and then you do your mailer. And then you register another event listener. That's another option. What about you, Sean?
Yeah, so what you were kind of describing there for a minute was like a transaction script. Like
right.
A user exactly. Signs up, and then this list of things happens. You know, we create the user, we send them an email, we sign them up to MailChimp. We, you know, do this, do that, queue up a mail to be sent to them in 7 days, something like that.
Right.
Now, those fall apart. They become unmanageable at a certain point. Now, at a certain level of complexity, that may be great. It may be really easy to understand. It may not be a problem at all. But I've kind of gotten to the point in a couple of my apps where that kind of thing was just no longer an option. So I kind of went on a walkabout trying to figure out, you know, how to handle this. And so I ended up falling into domain events. And this is how I kind of got into DDD in the first place. So now in my mind, the domain is a specific place that contains high-level policy. It contains the concepts like when a user signs up, this sort of thing happens, this sort of thing fires off. When a forum post is replied to, you know, we need to go out and notify everybody who's subscribed. We need to maybe scrape that forum post for any time somebody said at and then a nickname, and then notify that person that they were tagged in a message. There's a significant number of things, because like where a transaction script would fail here is that, okay, now that notifications have been sent out, what about those people who wanted their notifications emailed them to them? What about those people who wanted their notifications stored in a digest and sent to them every day or every week?
Right.
It's just impossible to do it with a transaction script at that level of complexity. So that's exactly the level of complexity that I got to before realizing that something really had to change. So now I think of the domain as just high-level policy. What should happen? And then the service layer is there to orchestrate kind of interactions with the domain. So, for example, and I talk about all of this. This is the exact topic of my talk at Laracon in New York City.
Well, don't feel like you have to ruin it.
Yeah. So, but it's to me, these are kind of like where I'm very passionate right now. But in my mind, if you're going to add a user to your application, that user is that adding that user, it has an implication to your domain. It matters. You need to be able to do stuff. You need to be able to follow up with things like the person needs to be notified, the person, you know, any number of things that are important to your business have to happen. So what I do is when I go to add that user, I fire off an event saying that user has been created. And then I have a number of listeners that are listening for that user created event. But when I add that user, maybe I fire off more than one event. Maybe I fire off different events based on different situations. It just doesn't matter anymore because the events then arc out and handle everything. Each of those events has the opportunity to, again, through the service layer, interact with the domain and trigger more events. And this is kind of where this complexity kind of bites me in the ass a little bit. If you're trying to troubleshoot an event-driven system like this, and when I say event, I am absolutely not saying the Laravel event system. That's completely different. Those are hooks into components of Laravel, the framework. What I'm talking about is like events, like when a user is created, you want to trigger a different behavior, which we call domain events. But yeah, you're trying to troubleshoot through these chains of events can be absolutely awful. So you almost have to just be really careful and build up your debugging stuff a little bit. Like I just have it so it logs out whenever an event's fired and what listener picks it up just automatically. Because using things like a command bus and an event dispatcher, they give you a centralized point that you can do that sort of thing. So whenever the command bus is fired, I can just log out. Okay, the command bus has received this command, and it's decided to send it to this handler for whatever arbitrary reason. But I think that that's a really solid way, and ever since I started doing this in my apps, I am able to think clearly through the problem, unlike before. So I don't like to implement design patterns if they make it harder to understand. I only like to implement them if they make it more easy to understand. So to me, this is a pattern that really says to me there's something here, there's value here. I don't know if this exact implementation is the best way to do something specific. However, I do know that there are advantages in this approach over the way I was doing it that is making my job easier, the quality of my product better, and just like the ease of ability to make modifications to a system like this is significant. And again, I talk about this for 45 minutes at Laracon in New York City. So definitely, if you're in New York City with us, find me, talk to me about this stuff. As you can probably tell, I love talking about this stuff. I'm very passionate. Mitchell is as well. We'll both be there and happy to talk to everybody and get their ideas about this kind of thing and kind of go from there. So yeah.
That's yeah, very cool.
That might actually segue nicely into the PHP storm, as usual, section of our podcast. right. I finally figured out how to use XDebug to stop execution where I want, to add a breakpoint, which actually might be pretty useful for trying to follow, the execution path of your code. So anyway, I got the help of Dan Horrigan. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. I'm not sure. But he helped me figure that out a lot. So I'm going to blog about that at some point soon. It's cause, I can never get XDebug to talk to PHP Storm before. There's always some like gap missing in whatever article I found online.
Cool.
So how do you feel now that you're working with a debugger rather than like echo statements everywhere?
I just figured it out yesterday, so I'll let you know.
Oh, okay. I thought you might have been using XDebug from like the shell or something.
No. Have I done anything cool with that? I really haven't yet. I make use of logging, like Sean was saying, to follow kind of execution paths or, the good old fashioned var dump.
DD, baby.
Yeah.
People like to hate on DD, but I happen to like it.
Yeah, DD's magic.
I have a giant crutch, and it's called DD.
I like the story of how, like, with one of the releases, Taylor removed that function, and then everyone got pissed off, and there was, like, 10 pull requests adding it back in all at once.
Dude, that was not a fun couple of days in the chat room. That was bad.
That's awesome.
That was back when Laravel used to change, like, at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll be at version 4 for a long time also. Taylor can't be here to talk to it, but one of the user questions we had was the future direction of Laravel. So towards that, I think, you know, Laravel is going to be stable at 4 for, you know, the foreseeable future. And I think his plan is to, you know, just add features as it makes sense to, and also to do what he does best, which is to make complicated stuff simple. So, you know, we'll see some additional packages, I'm sure, come out and that kind of thing that really try to simplify all these processes we have to do all the time.
I think that's a good thing. Somebody tweeted me the other day asking whether their team should use Laravel or Zend, and I was saying I was a big fan of Laravel, and he was saying his coworkers, the other developers, had a hard time with it, and they were just completely basing it on the life cycle. So Laravel can't compete with Zend when it's been out so much longer. So their concern was, well, we can't invest all of this energy into this framework that very well might not be around in a year's time. And so it's tough to answer that question because, of course, my answer is, oh, you don't need to worry about that at all. But it's still a valid concern that they have.
It also depends on your team, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, completely. So I think it's good that Laravel's going to stay in the 4.star area for a good time. If it just keeps jumping up 5, 6, you know, like on one hand, that sounds cool. It sounds like it's advancing very quickly. But for some of these teams, it just seems like it's changing left and right. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
Well, the core of Laravel 4 is the container and the service providers. And then just in general, the structure of the repositories that make up the framework. So if there's not a particular reason to change the container or the Git repositories and the way it's structured, then there's no reason to go from 4. From here, you can just do major revisions. If you want to really start gutting stuff and changing backwards compatibility, yeah, I mean, you're going to probably have to wait until later or something. But still, I mean, a major revision is just you shouldn't be upgrading from 4 to 4.1 just for no reason out of nowhere. You should sit down and figure out what's going on and then make a measured step forward. You don't just... It's not like a minor revision, like 4.1.1 to 4.1.2, which you can probably just, you know, composer update and be done with. You know, there's a reason that going from 4.0 to 4.1 and probably 4.1 to 4.2 will have some upgrading instructions because, I mean, things change and that's just how it is. You can't update people's application skeletons because if you're anything like me, you're trashing your application skeletons the second you get them.
Right. So I have a quick announcement about Laracon New York City. Nothing grand, but BeSnappy.com is one of the sponsors, you know, as being part of the Userscape of Laracon New York City. They're going to have a live blog during both days, right? So that's at live.besnappy.com, which is actually live right now. You can see it. There's just no content because no one's live blogging right now. But that will be available, and someone will be manning that for the whole duration of Laracon New York.
That's a neat little idea. I like that.
Do you know who's going to be doing that?
Alyssa and the Userscape team.
Oh, okay. Nice.
And then that'll also have contributions from the rest of us also.
Very cool.
Yeah, so we can't do live streaming. That is terribly, terribly expensive, apparently. And actually, Sean, I don't know if you ever looked into that.
Yeah. Actually, we have the opportunity to do it at EU, kind of, but I don't think that it's going to be within our budget. And so it's complicated. It's just there's a lot of things involved with that.
Right. So the next best thing is this live blogging platform we're using, so should be good.
Speaking, do you have a way for users to kind of patch in with, like, a hashtag? So let's say, like, I take a picture of Sean up on stage. Can I kind of send that to LiveBlog? Or
are we
just
assuming
Alyssa's going to grab all of it?
She'll probably grab it. Right now, it's a WordPress plugin.
So it
probably has, you know, some functionality, but not all the functionality. You know, of maybe if there's, like, a SaaS platform out there or something that does it. But
as like a gift to our listeners here, we're not going to tweet about this or anything. Thank you for listening and for making it this far in this episode specifically. We want to give you a discount to purchasing Laracon EU tickets. So until Laracon New York City starts, you'll be able to use the discount code LARAVELIO, all one word, lowercase, no punctuation, and you'll be able to get a discount off of that ticket. I'm not sure exactly the amount of discount, so I don't want to say it right now. It's a pretty decent discount, and hopefully, it helps some people be able to go.
Good. So it's a good little thank you. I like it.
Okay. Well, I think that we're at about time, and our podcasts are starting to run longer and longer, I'm noticing.
Four people makes the difference.
It's good. It's really fun.
I still think it's the right number, though. Four is better than three.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys so much. Chris and Jeffrey, thanks for coming back. Matt, I contacted you no more than an hour before the podcast, and you biked home in that time. And thank you so much for filling in for Taylor today.
Oh, no problem.
Well, thanks again for listening to the podcast. We'll see you next time or something.
Good ending.
I'm sorry. I just hate. I hate endings and beginnings.
I was about to say thanks to you, but I thought you would try again. So I was just like, I'm going to start. No, I'm just